Welcome to the October webinar for the British Institute of Persian Studies, The Reunification of Iran and the Reign of Muhammad Shah Qajar by Mazyar Behrouz. We're really delighted to have Mazyar Behrouz here this afternoon, or in his case, this morning. He was born in Tehran, Iran. He received his BA degree in History and Government from St. Mary College of California. He had his MA in Modern History of Europe from San Francisco State University, and his PhD in Modern History of the Middle East from the University of California, Los Angeles. This is, of course, some of you will know that I did my PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles, so you will detect a pattern of my kind of being very pro-UCLA. Presently, Mazyar is an associate professor at the History Department of San Francisco State University. He's authored numerous articles and book chapters on Iran, and has authored two books on the history of the left movement in Iran. The first, Rebels with a Cause, 1999, has been translated into both Persian and Turkish. His second book is Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause in Iran, 2006, and the latter is a collection of articles and interviews on the left movement in Iran, and again translated and published in Iran. His current research project is about late 18th century, early 19th century encounters between Iran and the Western world, is entitled Iran at War, Interactions with the Modern World and the Struggle with Imperial Russia, 2023. So with no further ado, Mazyar, I'm going to let you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I would like to first thank you, the British Institute of Persian Studies, for the invitation, particularly Professor Andrew Newman and Ms. Sylvia Ferrari for organizing this event. My talk is about basically Iran at the end of the 18th century, when reunification of Iran occurs. Under Agha Muhammad Shah of the Qajar tribe, which becomes the Qajar Qabanlu dynasty. Iran had a very difficult century in the 1700s. Civil wars, foreign intervention, fragmentation, population loss, and other calamities, and the civil wars were particularly devastating. And after the fall of the Safavid state in 1722, you have a period of civil war between 1722 and 1736, which reunification occurs under Nader Shah Afshar. Now, Nader Shah was not a leader from a tribal nobility. He was from humble origins and from the Afshar tribe. And the Afshar tribe was a Ghazalbash tribe, which means they were Shias and they were supporters and followers of the Safavid dynasty and the Safavid Sufi order. Nader Shah was from humble origins, and what he lacked for, being from noble blood, in quotation, compensated by with his military genius, and he used that to basically reconstitute the Safavid dominion and even expand it, which was a monumental task because Iranian society at this point is very much fragmented into different tribal groups, and overcoming this fragmentation and gaining the loyalty of various tribes itself was a monumental task. But Nader did it with military force and military genius. What he failed to do before he began to lose his mental faculty was to create a strong and succession method or succession rules and regulation as who would succeed him. He blinded his capable son, who was a military leader, and he began to lose his faculty, and then he was assassinated in 1747, which is the start of a new round of civil war, and which comes to an end by 1751, when the Zand tribe, basically under Karim Khan from the city of Shiraz, unifies only parts of the former dominion of the Safavid state. A part of the Khorasan, for example, goes to the descendants of Nader Shah. Afghanistan, what became Afghanistan, was under the Durrani dynasty, Ahmad Shah Durrani or Abdali, and central and western Iran was under the Zand. However, nevertheless, the Zand period, 1751 to 1779 was a period of relative tranquility and harmony and prosperity for Iran under Karim Khan. Karim Khan also failed to establish an orderly succession method or rules for people who would succeed him. And when he died in 1779, fighting broke out between his successors, his brothers, his sons, his nephew, which gave an opening to other groups to intervene and try to grab the throne from the Zand, which is what actually happened. Which brings me now to Agha Mohammad Shah of the Qajar Qabanlu tribe and clan. Agha Mohammad Shah's grandfather, Fateh Ali Khan Qabanlu Qajar, was assassinated in a conspiracy involving Nader in the 1720s, when he was trying to help a Safavid pretender to reconstitute the Safavid dominion. His father, Muhammad Hasan Khan Qabanlu Qajar, was killed in battle while fighting against Karim Khan Zand. When Nader Shah was assassinated, a nephew of Nader Shah contending for power when the civil war after his assassination started again, managed to get a hold of Muhammad Hasan Khan's family, and his eldest son, Agha Mohammad, was then about 6 years old, and he was castrated in order to knock him out of competition for political power, for royal power, which was kind of short of killing royal blood. It was a common thing to do back then within the context of that of the culture of the time, to maim and to hurt a person so visibly that they would be not considered for royal power. To my knowledge, and I have researched this, but I'm open to suggestions. To my knowledge, in the annals of history, there has never been a eunuch king. Eunuchs have reached high positions. In China, they became powerful in Ottoman court. In China, they became commanders of the fleet and even higher than that. But a king, a royal absolute monarch, I have not been able to find anybody else who had managed that. But he did, Agha Mohammad did. So the Qajars, came from Central Asia with the Turco-Mongol migration and invasion. They proved to be good fighters, and they settled in what is today Syria first. But when Tamerlane, Amir Taimur, found them to be too powerful numerically and otherwise, he wanted them to move back to east of the Caspian Sea, Turkestan, But by the time they reached halfway on their migration back, Timur had died, his empire collapsed, and the Qajars basically settled in what is today Iranian Azerbaijan and the Caucasus north of the Aras River, particularly Ganje and Karabakh. And there they remained until the Safavids, Shah Abbas I, tried to weaken the Qajars again because of their powerful numbers and their warrior-like. The Qajars had converted from Sunni Islam to Shia Islam and had become supporters and followers of the Safavid order sometimes in the 1400s. But in the early 1600s, the Shah Abbas decided to split the Qajars into three branches. One branch settled in Asarabad, which is Gurgaon today, and that's where the dynasty came from. Fast forward, Karim Khan basically arrested and brought the family of the Qajar, Muhammad Hasan Khan, after he was killed in battle, to Shiraz. He married Muhammad Hasan Khan's sister, and he kept the his sons, his two sons, particularly him, and Agha Muhammad and his brother, his full brother, Jahan Suz, in Shiraz as hostage, so that the Qawanluz up in north, in the north, would behave well. He provided them with good education, he provided them with other necessities of a royal blood, needed for the royal blood to prosper. Agha Muhammad, however, seems to have kept a grudge against the Zand and found them responsible, Karim Khan responsible for the death of his father. When Karim Khan died in 1779, he was on a hunting trip outside the city of Shiraz, so he rushed back to his base up north in Asarabad, and there once the civil war began, he began to contend for power for a third time. This is the third time a Qajar, Qawanlu Qajar, was trying to get the throne. Agha Muhammad and the Qajars are basically demonized, demonized after the Qajar was removed from the throne in 1925 by the Pahlavi historians. And they were demonized for being weak, resisting reforms in the 19th century, to the point that the positive aspects of the Qajar period was often neglected during the Pahlavi period. One of the people who was heavily was put in the under a very negative light is Agha Muhammad. Both during his lifetime, because he was a eunuch, his enemies called him with derogatory names, of course. And after the Qajars were removed from the throne by the Pahlavis. So I would like to talk a little bit about him and his reign in the context that I just provided to you. He wasn't a very capable military commander, but by all accounts, he was a very a prudent person, a very good diplomat, but a very ruthless man as well. During the period that he lived, violence came with the job, and I would say even extreme violence. So it is the, you know, the way I look at it, his violent behavior, and which is true, he was violent, was no more than what for example, Nader Shah was, or Shah Abbas the First was, or even Shah Ismail, the founder of the Safavids, were, let alone Amir Timur, Tamerlane, and others. So it comes from the, we have to understand his violent behavior in the context of the time, and perhaps because he was brutally done with during this period by castration, by what was done to him physically. He used his he is known to have been a very smart person, and he used his wit to co-opt as much as he could other tribes. And when he couldn't, then he would resort to war and conflict and then violence. When he became violent, he really became violent. He did that. So for one example, and this is his perhaps an important aspect of his reign, he wanted to create a succession system. And he wanted the son of his full brother, Jahan Suz, who had been killed years earlier, Fath Ali Khan, who was known as Baba Khan at the court. He wanted his firstborn, the son of his full brother, the firstborn of his full brother, to become his successor. So he had, Agha Muhammad Khan had many half-brothers, and he basically had many of them killed, even the loyal ones, in order to make sure that his nephew would not be challenged. And that system would take the Qajars from when he coronated, from his coronation in 1796 all the way to 1925. He stipulated that only a marriage between a Qawanlu, in this case Fath Ali Khan, and the most challenging other Qajar clan, the Develu, a woman from the Develu and a man from the Qawanlu, from the dynasty, can their firstborn son would become the successor, the crown prince, the heir apparent. So he united the Qawanlu and the Develu, who had been fighting with each other throughout the 1700s, and the fight had resulted into the death of his father because of that competition. They backstabbed each other. So he brought them together and used that unity of the Qajars of Asarabad to engage in the civil war, at the same time creating a dynastic system which would benefit both the Develu and the Qawanlu, his own clan. So that was a very smart thing to do. And then he set about conquering the rest of the region, perhaps his biggest and toughest enemy was the Zand, but the Zand were their own worst enemy. They kept fighting each other, and the last Zand was of course Lotf Ali Khan, who was captured at Bam, at the city of Bam, and then killed, the Zand were overthrown. Partial unification here occurred. Agha Muhammad chose Tehran as his center of power, decided to bring the Southern Caucasus, Southeastern Caucasus, under his control. He took his 60,000 man army, mostly cavalry, to the Caucasus. The most tragic and high point of this campaign was the sack of Tiflis, or Tbilisi, in September of 1795, which resulted into sacking of the city. We hear the number thousands of being killed and 15,000 being taken as hostage, or rather slaves to Iran. Slavery here at this point in history was common everywhere, Britain, France, everywhere, United States. But the number 15,000 taken from Tiflis to Tehran is solely based on Iranian accounts. And the Europeans often accuse Iranians during this period that they exaggerated the numbers. No matter what number they were using, they usually exaggerated statistics and numbers. One can claim that this is still happening today in a way. There is a, you know, zeros added to the number often when people talk about statistics. That said, that aside, on his way back, he accepted to become king. And then when he came to Tehran, he had a coronation, at his coronation. He used a crown this time. This is the first time that you see a king in Iran using a crown. The Safavids used some sort of a headgear with jewelry on it. Nader Shah had some sort of a hat on his head, but this is the Kiani crown, or the first version of the Kiani crown that he had built, he had made, and it looks like a Qazilbash hat. You can see the red on the top. Qazilbash means red head or red hat, which suggests that they were Shias and supporters of the Safavid Sufi order, so they were Sufis. Once he came back, Russia, which had made a major commitment to defend Georgia and Tiflis from Iran. The Georgian ruler had switched sides in 1783 and asked to be protected by Russia. But Russia didn't come to his aid for a variety of reasons, which I don't have the time to speak about it now. But once Aga Muhammad captured Georgia and sacked Tiflis, the Russians under Catherine I decided to retaliate. So they sent a large army to the Caucasus, southeastern Caucasus, while the Qajar army had disbanded. The Qajar army was basically a seasonal army, a tribal army. It didn't like to fight in the winter, and it would disband when it was not needed. Iran didn't have a standing army at this point. It only had a seasonal army. And his army was about 60,000, give and take. He disbanded the army, and then once in the summer, he was ready. He headed for Khorasan to overthrow the Afshar and gather the jewelry that was there at the hand of the descendants of Nader Shah. So while he was in Khorasan, the Russians invaded the Caucasus. But before anything can happen between the two armies, Catherine died. When Aga Muhammad Khan returned to Tehran to move against the Russians, he heard that Catherine had passed away, and his successor, Paul I, basically evacuated the region, asked the army to return. And Aga Muhammad then took his army and captured Shusha, which is in Qarabagh, and there he was assassinated in 1797. So he really only ruled for about a year as king, but he was the ruler of Iran for much longer, of course. So what is his legacy, and what we can say about him? If we put this other secondary issues aside, violence, the whole period was violent. and that he was a eunuch is completely irrelevant. And its relevancy is only that he was a very powerful, he had the will of iron to do what he did. So his legacy is that he was not able to reunify the whole Safavid state. He was planning to attack Samarkand and Bukhara when the Russians invaded from the northwest. He did unify the core dominion of Iran. And the name that the term that they used, Qajar historians use at this contemporary Qajar historians used was the term was Iran. They called their Qajar dominion the dominion of Iran. So that is very important. That is one of a big achievement. One cannot think about Iran as it is today without the reunification under him. The second important achievement was to create an orderly succession system, which I already explained to you. He collected all the jewelry that was dispersed, most of the jewelry that was dispersed when Nader was assassinated in 1747, and brought them to Iran, brought them to Tehran. They're all now in a safe in a central bank vault in Tehran. These are the imperial jewelry of Iran. People say, you know, he was tight with money, he was avarice, and he liked to play with his diamonds and precious stones. Yes, but the man didn't like luxury. He liked to live in the tent rather than in the building. He ate very modestly, and he left a chest full of valuable stones for his successor, Fath Ali Shah, the future Fath Ali Shah, or the Baba Khan Jahanbani. So that was important. When you put all of this together, then we can see at a pivotal time, at a very important, significant time, when Iran is going to be faced with imperialist onslaught from the south, the British, out of India, from the north, the imperial Russia. He managed to establish a strong state in Iran, which was able to, if not completely protect the dominion of Iran, but at least keep Iran on the map, which should have disappeared during the 19th century. He adequately reconstituted a dominion that was able to withstand complete colonization by his successors. And I think that is also an important legacy of our Muhammad Shah. I'm open to any possible questions and or suggestions.
That's terrific. Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Thank you, Mazar. We have a question here on the Khovanlu Davulu division and whether you could discuss that a bit more. Specifically, do you see this division as something with a history extending back into the Safavid period, that is an old feud, or is it a conflict deliberately seeded by the Afsharid and Zands? And to what extent could we see these two factions in particular as one that stemmed from kinship or other kinds of political interests?
Yeah, so the Khovanlu were when the Qajars were moved to the Qajar tribe under Shah Abbas was divided into three branches. One branch remained in the Caucasus, one branch was moved to Asarabad, and the other one to Marv to guard against Sunni Turk attacks. The Qajars of Asarabad then were divided into two branches, up the river of Gorgan River and down the Gorgan River. The Qawan Luz were the most powerful of the Qajar on Gorgon River, and the Devel Luz were the most powerful clan up the river Gorgon. They competed with each other for pasture, for influence at the court. Once civil war started, the Qawan Luz, Agha Muhammad's grandfather, Fateh Ali Khan Qawan Lu Qajar, came to the aid of the Safavid pretender, Tahmasp II, and was assassinated with Nader's cooperation because he became too powerful. The Qawan Luz, the Devel Luz, played a key part in the death of Muhammad Hasan Khan, Agha Muhammad Shah's father. And they also played a key role in the death of his full brother, Jahan Suz. The competition starts with issues such as pasture, but then this is a tribal society. Tribes bring in troops behind them. They contend for political power. And the Devel Lu and the Qawan Lu got entangled in that type of competition. Agha Muhammad Shah brought that to an end, to the extent that one historian, you would see that the Devel Luz would play a key role in defending Iran against Russia and providing the new dynasty with its statesmen, its military leaders, etc.
Could I poke around on that just a little bit? What happened to in this early period? Can we say anything about the other constituent members of the Qizilbash coalition? Under the Safavid, in the Safavid period.
Yeah.
So anything with Shamlu and the Zohar Khadar and such.
Some of them have disappeared. By the end of the 18th century, you have the Afshar. They are still there. They are divided in different areas, but the Afshar are still there. The Qajar are there. And some of the other smaller tribes, but I do not have a genealogy or what happened to them.
But there wasn't the same sort of coalition, that is, which had its hierarchical problems, but nevertheless there were a lot of constituent groups. It was mainly the dominant Qajars and such. Okay, terrific, thank you. And then I have a comment. Thank you for the wonderful presentation. Can you situate the Qajar reunification in the larger geopolitical context of the Middle East and South Asia and the emergence of company colonialism? Well, we're talking mainly, I think, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, still of the dominance of the East India Company, for example, I think is what's being put down here. And so how did the Qajar reunification figure in that process of company colonialism in the region as a whole? That is, where did Iran, reunified Iran, kind of fit into that larger dynamic and those larger connections?
Yeah, this goes to a period after Agha Muhammad Khan. The East India Company, yes, it is gradually taking over India. The East India Company's managers in India, in Calcutta, play a significant role in the British policy in the region, especially with Iran and Afghanistan. Tipu Sultan, for example, the Nawab of Mysore, did send emissaries to Iran and of course to Napoleon in order to gain help to fight against the company, but he was defeated and killed in 1799. Iran's reunification is important. You know, when John Malcolm comes to Iran in 1800, he is, you know, this is, give you an example. The East Indian Company is not secure in India. So when Malcolm comes to Iran in 1800, he wants Iran to commit itself to attack in to attack Afghanistan should the Afghan king attack the British in East India, in India. So that is a key request. They're trying, you know, they think Iran is so important. And Fateh Ali Shah look at Fateh Ali Shah as an ally that can help British dominate India. But that is going to change. I mean, the British are going to, the East India Company is going to take over not only India, but what is today Pakistan, and then subjugate Afghanistan to a protectorate level. And of course, Iran is going to become a semi-colony. So the British East India Company was the arm of British colonialism, not only in India, but in the, I think I would dare to say, all of West Asia.
Another point here, again, thank you for the great presentation. When people write Qajar history, they tend to fit Agha Muhammad Shah into the line of 18th century warlords, and treat Fateh Ali Shah as the true founder of the Qajar Empire, as the one who took a collection of conquered territories and stabilized the state and systematized its administration, foreign relations, etc. Do you agree with that assessment? Or if not, why should we regard Agha Muhammad as the foundational figure in Qajar history?
Yeah, in my book, I argue that Agha Muhammad Shah is a tribal king, and Fateh Ali Shah is a imperial king. So there's a difference between these two. Fateh Ali Shah, Agha Muhammad couldn't have children. Fateh Ali Shah had over 100 of them. So, you know, he created a dynasty where his uncle couldn't have even one. He had a great harem. He had a beard, but his uncle had no beard at all. Right, he looked like a, you know, close up. He looked like an old lady, and Fateh Ali Shah was tall by all accounts, and a beard up to his belly, down to his belly. So he lived in palaces. He created three thrones to sit on, and he created an imperial image. Agha Muhammad was a warrior king. He was from tribal nobility. He laid down the foundations and a system that would work, and then delivered a state, stable state, to his successor. And the successor now was in charge of guarding the domain. But when the century changes, the new century arrives, Iran is faced with powerful enemies, international intrigue, diplomatic backstabbing, that it was very difficult to handle. Remember, the Qajars are becoming an imperial dynasty. They are tribal nobility. How much do they know about the rest of the world? How much do they know about the intrigue in Europe? Ottoman Empire, next door neighbor, is a European power. China is a very old imperial dynasty, the Qing dynasty. They are going to go through the same, they are going to be very soon dominated, very similar to Iran, regardless of how powerful and how old and how capable they were. So Europe is catapulting ahead. Industrial revolution, democratic age of democratic revolutions, the Enlightenment, military revolution, which is completely changing the picture, the shape of warfare. All of this put together is going to overwhelm not only Iran, but the rest of the world. And Iran, under Agha Mohammad, was able to create at least a state structure, that would enable it to withstand colonialism.
Another question, which I think might relate to the previous question, was Agha Mohammad Shah, based on Qajar historical sources, aware of the idea of Iran, ancient Iran, for example, or was the unification just a clan-based project?
No, it was more than clan-based. You know, wherever you go in Iran, you will see symbols of the previous pre-Islamic Iranian dynasties. You know, at Persepolis, at Naqsh-e Rostam, you see it on mountains and carvings on hills and mountains, which Fath Ali Shah added to them, by the way. So, and Shahnameh, Iranians too, for a long time viewed Shahnameh of Abul Qasim Ferdowsi as real history of Iran. And Agha Mohammad Shah had Shahnameh read. No, these are Turks. The Qajars are Turks, Turkmens, but they were heavily influenced by pre-Islamic Iranian images. Agha Mohammad Khan had Shahnameh read to him every night before he went to bed. And Fath Ali Shah had Shahnameh read to him while he was on horseback, loudly. And where does the crown come from? Well, you look at all the images around Shiraz. This is where these people lived. Agha Mohammad Khan, Fath Ali Shah was born in Shiraz. All around Shiraz, you see a lot of images of pre-Islamic kings. Add that to Shahnameh. Where does crown come from? The crown comes from the images. So where does the title come from, Shahanshah? The images that the Qajars used were of three types: Iranian imperial images and titles. They used the Turco-Mongol images and titles. Fath Ali Shah is also called Khagan. Khagan is a very Turk-Mongol title. And he was also Padishah Islam Panah. He was the king protector of Islam. By this, I mean Shia Islam, of course. So they utilized all the images that they could pump up the legitimacy of the new dynasty. And I think they were not looking at this as a tribal conquest. They were looking at this certainly as an imperial establishment.
Right, okay, thank you. Could I ask my own question about religion and the faith, because you brought it up there. Can you make some sort of a comment about his relationship with the faith, but also with the ulama and the situation of the ulama in that area as he's expanding and re-aggrandizing Iran? How was that viewed by the Shi'i ulama who were resident in Iran, or even those who, of course, were outside it?
Both Agha Mohammad and Fath Ali Shah were very respectful to Shia clergy. Unlike the Safavids, they did not claim descent from the house of the Prophet, and they did not claim to be the head of the church of sort. So they were very respectful. Fath Ali Shah particularly spent a lot of money refurbishing Shia sites in Ottoman Iraq, particularly in Karbala. In Karbala, Agha Mohammad is buried in Karbala. There is a segment in the tomb of Imam Hussein, which belongs to the Qajar kings. The last Qajar king is also buried there, Ahmad Shah. So they had a respectful, very respectful relationship. The only people who could approach Agha Mohammad Shah and not get hurt without his permission, of course, were ulama. Everybody else had to, I don't know, bow 15 times to get even close to him. However, the Qajars were Ghazalbash. These had a strong Ghazalbash background. And it is not surprising that foreigners who visited Iran noticed that they drink a lot of wine, alcohol. They consume a lot of alcohol. When there was a big party at the court, courtiers would ask permission from Fath Ali Shah, can we have wine? And then he would say, okay, yes, have wine. And then wine would come out and they would drink. And during the coronation of Aga Muhammad Shah, there was wine served. The Ghazalbash, I mean, one European observer says he had never seen the Ottomans drink so much alcohol that Iranians do. These are Qajars, and the Qajars are Ghazalbash, and they have and the Ghazalbash were Sufis, and Sufis consume wine, and that did really contradict their faith somehow.
I have a question about the Shahnameh, which you mentioned, and the Shahnameh serving as a literary vehicle for the Persian-speaking people of present-day Iran, in Afghanistan and Tajikistan, and you alluded to its being read to the Shah. Is there a comment about that that you could make relevant to the situation of Persian speakers, for example, in the area at the time? You mentioned also that he was native Turkic or Turkoman.
The Fath Ali Shah also had his collection of his poetries in Persian. So he was into writing Persian. I mean, education, if you want to receive a proper education, and Aga Muhammad and Fath Ali Shah received proper education at the court of Shiraz, it would have had to be in Persian. So they were bilingual to begin with. They were Turks, but they were also fluent in Persian to the point that Shahnameh, a book of poetry praising Fath Ali Shah, and Fath Ali Shah himself writing poetry in Persian. So Persian was, of course, the language of bureaucracy as well. A class of Persian-speaking bureaucrats served the Qajars, which they have been doing it for centuries, with bureaucratic scribal services.
The other thing I wanted to ask about, in addition to the ulama and also the language question, was the extent of foreign trade relations at this point. So the point you were making about the company system transitioning, as it were, into the capital system across the 19th century. So in this period of his own rule, to what extent are there foreign relations and such going on, for example, with the great European powers, much as there was in the Safavid period? The Safavids were always looking to play the Ottomans and the European card, for example. What was his foreign policy strategy at this point, vis-a-vis the Ottomans and the Europeans? Did he have that same fear of the Ottomans and then wanting to cozy up to the French, the British, whatever? Or were the British more an enemy at this point?
Regarding the Ottomans, the Qajars, although they're both Turks, they didn't think very highly of the Ottomans. The Qajar Shah expected that the governor of Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq today to be appointed with consultation between the Ottoman Sultan and Iranian Shah. When that didn't happen, or when the Pasha of Baghdad, for example, on one occasion toppled the governor of Sulaymaniyah, war broke out. And the commander of the war with the Ottomans was usually Muhammad Ali Mirza Dolat Shah, who was the firstborn son of the of Fateh Ali Shah, but not from the right mother, from a Georgian mother. Dolat Shah was usually, because he was the governor of Kermanshah, he was usually in charge of fighting with the Ottomans, and the fight usually went Iranian way, interestingly. This is a hard time for the Ottoman Empire. They are trying to reform and get rid of the Janissaries and bringing new forces. And the pashas in the different regions are left to their own accord to fight the Russians or the Iranians. The relationship was so bad that they could never really, and the French tried this very hard, to unite them against the Russians. And this Shia Sunni divide and this dislike for each other, although they were both Turks, but they were of two different branches of Islam, prevented them from meaningful unity. As with Europeans, Europeans sent diplomatic missions to Iran, which also acted as espionage missions. For example, Napoleon wanted the General Garden, to provide modern army and rifles and training to the Shah, but also make an assessment of can Iran afford to have a 30,000 man army move through Iran toward India, because he was really thinking about, you know, had plans for capturing India. He couldn't do it through high seas because the Brits had sunk his navy, so he wanted to walk to India. And so of course that gives us a vast amount of information, because the French and the British envoys were asked to give a precise account of population, roads, buildings, cities, churches, mosques, and that's how we have a lot of information through them. The French experience was very brief, but the British had a permanent mission in Iran. But the problem with the British was that the Shah expected the ambassador to come from London. And this is one big problem between Iran and the British Empire. The Shah wanted the envoy to be from London and not from the company. The British wanted the company to be in charge of the ambassadorial mission to Iran. So there was a point of friction between the two. The British didn't really have an ambassador in Iran from 1814 until 1826, when MacDonald arrived. They had a chargé d'affaires, but they had a permanent mission. The Russians had temporary missions. They would come and go. And the governor of Tiflis, the Russian governor of Tiflis, was put in charge of dealing with Iran. He would, to the point that he could stop Iranian envoys going to St. Petersburg. He had to permit them to go to St. Petersburg. So everything is between Iran and Russia goes through Tiflis. And of course, that is how the Second War started, because the Russian governor wanted to take the rest of the Caucasus from Iran, and that's how he started the war.
I have one last question. Could you discuss the non-textual sources for the Agha Mohammad Shahn period, particularly in architecture and material culture?
Not much that I could identify. I mean, there are some buildings from that period in terms of architecture. There is a building in Gorgan, Asarabad, which used to be his palace. It's an administrative center right now. And parts of the Golestan Palace are associated with him. But he was not a big builder, was he? He was always fighting, and his reign was really short. You can say he didn't really have that much time to do things. Fateh Ali Shah is the person who had done much of the buildings. He loved to build palaces everywhere he went. So you can see some building or structure named after him.
Okay. Maziar, thank you very, very much. I appreciate this. Good for us UCLA people, you know, kind of stick together and such like
Thank
that.
you.
So very good to see you again. May I bid everybody a good morning or a good afternoon or a good evening. And thank you very much from BIPS.